We have made you, O Adam, a creature neither of heaven nor earth, neither mortal nor immortal, in order that you may, as the free and proud shaper of your own being, fashion yourself in the form you may prefer. It will be in your power to descend to the lower, brutish forms of life, or you will be able, through your own decision, to rise again to the superior orders, whose life is divine. That is God talking to man in The Oration of the Dignity of Man, written in 1486 by the Renaissance humanist Giovanni Pico della Mirandola. And it is also the way that the comic book writer Grant Morrison ends his book Super Gods, a history of superheroes, in which he says they represent our enduring thirst for the cosmic and the sacral. Now, who better to discuss this subject in the very week the new Spider-Man film comes out than our very own Tom Holland? Still, for my money, one of the top two Tom Hollands.
Dominic, that is so kind of you.
So, Tom, you took a tiny bit of we've mentioned the sacral, but you took a tiny bit of persuasion to do this subject because the existence of Tom Holland is a running sore, isn't it, for you?
Well, I don't begrudge his existence, but I think that I suppose what makes it funny for people and people have been making jokes about it for at least seems like an eternity is that I don't really know anything about superheroes. I mean, I know a bit because you've told me to read Grant Morrison's book, and I realized reading it that occasionally I have stumbled across superheroes, but for some reason, they were never part of my childhood particularly. And so, I mean, it's not an ideal way, perhaps, to start a podcast to say I don't really know anything about the subject.
But you do. I think you do. I think you know more than you think.
Well, I agree. Because reading Grant Morrison's book, I realize actually I have come across them quite a lot. But for instance, I've never read a superhero comic.
All right. Well, prepare to be
never
educated.
Read one.
Prepare to be educated. But before we do that, Tom, the great news of the week, which we haven't talked about yet, the big news is the amazing response to the launch of what I could see as the Avengers of the history world, or the Justice
X-Men.
League. Yeah, well, the X-Men are mutants, so I don't know what that's the comparison I go for.
Well, I'm betraying my ignorance there.
Which is the Rest is History Club, the launch of the Rest is History Club. So thank you so much to everybody who signed up. We're delighted to have you on board. To those of you who haven't signed up,
why? Why not?
Well, there is that. But of course, you'll still get your podcast as normal.
Of course. Of course.
So, and it is just £6 a month, but I promise not to mention that again. But Tom, the thing that I've really enjoyed is dipping into the Discord community.
Yes, which sounds very superhero.
Yeah, very superhero.
It?
Yeah, it's like Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
And it's rather startling because I would not have put you down as someone who was necessarily into dipping into things called the Discord, but it turns out to be your superpower.
Yeah,
you're really good at it. You've obviously been bitten by a radioactive ant or something.
I have.
In the Cotswolds.
So in the Rest is History, in the Discord community, you know, they have a whole thread of people in the Rest is History Club who are from the Midlands, a Mercian community.
And from East Anglia, I see.
There's an East Anglia.
Which you made
one.
a very rude joke about mine.
Well, there was one guy who went on, he said, is there anyone here from East Anglia? And I said, well, if you've listened to our CIA podcast, you'll know that Liam Neeson will be along in a minute.
Yes, very funny. So so it's pile into me, my inability to do a Liam Neeson accent, and the fact, ha, 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 that I share the name with the actor who plays Spider-Man.
Yeah, we should mention, we've got bonus episodes coming up.
Oh, yes, sorry.
For our members. So the bonus episodes will be out every week. And this week, so Wednesday, the 15th of December at 8 p.m.
8 o'clock British time.
We're doing our first live streamed show for Rest is History Club members, which is all about the 1960s. Looking forward to that?
I certainly am. It's a great topic. It's a topic we're both very much interested in. You know a lot more about than I do, but I have views.
Yeah, I know you have views.
Which I know you'll look forward to hearing all about.
I do. So if you can't make it and you're a Rest is History Club member, you will get a chance to access it afterwards. Don't worry. If you're not a Rest is History Club member, well, you won't, but I mean...
But you could sign up between now and Wednesday and then you get to hear it.
Where would you sign up, Tom?
You'd go to restishistorypod.com.
Very good. All right. Enough of the club promotion. Let's talk about superheroes. Do you have a question? I think you have a question that you'd like to ask.
I do. It's from SO3 Clausewitz, who put it on the Discord.
He did. Think.
And he asked, what caused the sudden rise of superhero stories in the mid-20th century? And that's an absolutely banging question with which to kick the show off.
So my answer to that would be, it's kind of, there's a kind of sort of almost like a boring logistical reason, which is that in 1933, you have the launch of comic books. So a man called Max Gaines, I can't remember, it's called Something Funnies. It's the first sort of comic book. It's a way of using the printing presses. It's cheap. Initially, they're reproducing
it's
cartoon strips from...
A four-colour printing process.
Yeah. So it's very simple.
So it enables that kind of bright...
exactly. The lurid colours that
the lurid colours. So it's... I mean, we keep coming to this, that it's kind of technological innovations that then precipitate cultural processes of change.
But obviously there are cultural roots to the superhero, aren't there? Longer roots. So,
well, yeah, there's we've had a lot of questions about that. So Pedida4 on Twitter, did the Romans think of mythical heroes the same way? Diogo Morgado, are superheroes in modern mythology? Henry Midgley, do you think there's any genealogical link between the modern concept of superheroes and the Greek hero? Have we modernized Hercules and made him Spider-Man? Hazim, I mean, is modern superheroes' morality and reluctance to take human life a symbol of Christian morality in contrast to the Norse sagas or Greek?
All right, so Grant Morrison, putting it in his book, basically...
All in the context of ancient
says
mythology.
He says super gods, he sees them as... He has that thing about the quote from Giovanni Pico della Mirandola about... sort of man caught between the kind of base and the divine, and this sort of humanistic kind of reaching for something beyond and all this kind of stuff. Now, I know that you don't really buy all that, do you? Amazingly, for once,
you don't see them
as Christian.
I don't really think it's anything to do with Christianity.
I don't think it's anything
to do with Greek myth or Norse myth or anything like that.
But, okay, let me get the counter-argument though, Tom, which you need to dispel, is... you've got Thor, you've got a lot of sort of Greek and Roman influences. So Captain Marvel, when Captain Marvel is created, he's one of the first sort of superheroes in the 1940s or whatever. And there's a sort of, he gets his powers from Solomon, Hercules, Atlas, Zeus, Achilles and Mercury, which is the
Shazam.
Shazam, exactly. Yeah. Right. I mean, is that link not obvious there? Or do you think that's just complete window dressing and it's utterly contrived?
Older listeners may remember that in the 70s, there was a TV show called Mr. Ben. And the plot of was that Mr. Ben wore a bowler hat. He'd walk along the street. He'd go into a fancy dress shop. And the shopkeeper would magically appear and lend him a fancy dress outfit. And it might be a Roman soldier or a caveman or a cowboy or whatever.
Yeah.
And Mr. Ben would go into the changing room and he'd put this outfit on, and then he'd enter a kind of magical world where, you know, if he'd put on the caveman show, there'd be dinosaurs. If he put the Romans on, he'd be, you know, in ancient Rome or whatever. So it would go on. I mean, I think that basically that's the level that superheroes operate on. These are essentially, it seems to me, vigilante figures.
Yeah,
they're bred of the very specific circumstances of kind of American history, attitudes towards policing, attitudes towards the individual picking up arms to defend the American way of life. Mm-hmm. And basically, these are people who are cosplaying. They are characters that may well, you know, you may well get Thor, you may well get Wonder Woman drawing on the Amazons or whatever, but it... You know, we're not in the level, say, of Tolkien with his fantasy.
Yeah,
clearly drawing on a deep knowledge of ancient literature, ancient myth, Christian myth, whatever, to amplify his world. This none of these characters seem really to have any interest in that. I mean, it's about fights. It's about costumes.
Yeah.
And that's basically the limit of it. And that's true whether it's, you know, the most basic kind of wham-bam kind of Adam West type Batman cartoon shows where it's played for laughs and it's camp, or the kind of the Watchmen, the dark, the somber, the kind of Finnegan's Wake version of comic book. They're still not really interested in any of these kind of mythic antecedents.
I think there's a lot.
They're interested in America.
Yeah.
20th century America.
But hold on. Okay. They're interested in 20th century. They're born in 20th century America, and particularly in the 1930s. And we'll come to that in a second. But for example, Ian B, who's one of our Athelstan members of the Rest is History Club, he asked a question on the Discord chat. And he says, There's a compelling argument that Sherlock Holmes is the original superhero. Do you agree? Or he asks about other figures from history who lay the groundwork. Achilles, Alexander, King Arthur, Robin Hood. I would say there is some slight lineage, some very faint lineage from Robin Hood, the folk hero, the outlaw.
Who wears a mask.
Who wears a mask and has a hideout and has sidekicks.
Yeah.
I think Sherlock Holmes, Tom? We talked about Sherlock Holmes as a superhero in our Sherlock Holmes podcast.
Well, we know that, and I know that from having read Grant Morrison's book, that the guys who invent Batman say that he has the athleticism of D'Artagnan, so one mm-hmm. of the you know, confusingly, he's the fourth musketeer in the three musketeers.
Yes.
And the brain power of Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
So that's a conscious, absolutely.
So Sherlock Holmes is definitely in the air when they're writing these things.
Well, and what I'd also say is that, I mean, we talked about this on the Sherlock Holmes episode, that London is one, you know, is a character in Sherlock Holmes. In a yeah. sense, people's understanding of London is still shaped by that. And I would say that Batman's Gotham City
yeah.
well, has an analogous role.
People call New York Gotham, don't they? I mean, they use the words almost interchangeably.
But right the way through, you know, all the way that Batman's being portrayed, New York Gotham is a character in the way that London yeah. is a character in the Sherlock Holmes stories.
I think that's very true. I think that's absolutely right. But I think there are two other characters, actually, that are worth mentioning that are definitely there when the superhero creators are working in the late 1930s. One of them, very unexpected, actually, to some listeners, is the Scarlet Pimpernel. And actually, lots of comic book historians say the Scarlet Pimpernel is massive.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Scarlet Pimpernel was created initially in a play by Baroness Auxly in 1903 and then the book in 1905. So the Scarlet Pimpernel is set in the French Revolution. He rescues French. He's masked. He's incredibly swashbuckling. He's like a musketeer. He rescues French aristocrats from the guillotine. But the interesting thing there, and what makes him clearly an antecedent of later characters, Clark Kent and Peter Parker and so on, is that he has a dual identity. So one is the Scarlet Pimpernel, the superhero, and the other is this foppish, effeminate
yeah.
weed called Sir Percy Blakeney. And he plays up to that part, just like Bruce Wayne does, or just like yeah. Clark Kent does. He plays the weed to disguise the French about his real identity. And I think most comic book historians say, you know, Scarlet Pimpernel is huge in the culture of the 1910s and 1920s. They would all have been aware of it. And the other character who he perhaps partly inspires is Zorro.
Yes, who was also masked.
Yeah, and Zorro was very familiar to us, I would imagine, when we grew up. But I think mm-hmm. he's kind of forgotten now, isn't he? Do you think kids now know who Zorro is?
There was a film, wasn't there? There was a film recent.
Yeah, but that's 25 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah.
I mean, it seems recent to us, but
yeah,
not.
Yeah, I agree. Yes.
So he's the same thing. He really is a masked vigilante that he's created in 1919. He has that dual identity. So he's Don Diego de la Vega, but he's also Zorro. He has the Z symbol that he kind of carves into things and stuff with his sword, which is very sort of like the bat symbol or whatever. So I think though they're clearly in the ether in the 30s.
But also, I mean, supervillains. So I would say Fantomas.
Yeah.
Who this super criminal who haunts Paris rather yeah. in the way that the Joker and Penguin come to haunt Gotham.
Fu Manchu, I suppose, is a bit
and
of
Fu
a
Fu Manchu, absolutely. Yeah. And this is the kind of intersection point between, I guess, kind of Bond and superheroes.
Yeah.
Is this idea of global conspiracies.
Yes.
But whereas the Bond ones are, however baroquely, kind of grounded in contemporary geopolitics. And I know that Superman and Batman do take on Hitler in the war. Essentially, the villains are completely abstracted from contemporary politics.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, I know that...
So Superman at first, though, is a bit more grounded, I would say.
Well, I mean, in more recent ones, I know that it is more rooted. But I think kind of, you know, through the 40s, 50s, 60s, these are, I mean, it's for children.
Well, let's start with Superman, because Superman's the first canonical superhero, isn't he, I suppose. He's born in 1938, middle of 1938, and what makes him emblematic of the sort of story generally is, like so many of these superheroes, they're created by Jewish writers and illustrators who are themselves kind of dual identity because they've changed their names often.
Right, which is, I think, another reason for not thinking that this is necessarily Christian, because people so often say about Superman, isn't he? He comes from Krypton, which dies, and he's reborn and all this kind of stuff.
But some writers have said it's the story of Moses and the bulrushes or whatever.
So I think there are elements perhaps of that. As there comes to be with Spider-Man as well, that perhaps there are echoes of kind of biblical prophets who are called to save their people. But I think that I really, really think it's this should not be overdone. I mean, these are basically, it seems to me, fantasies about... Well, so there's a question here from Tom McTague, a very distinguished political journalist for The Atlantic. Are superheroes essentially right-wing conservative as they are romantic fantasies of individual heroism, restoring honour and justice to a decadent world? And that does seem to me basically to be what they're about.
You think that's what, but I don't. See, I don't think that.
I think they're cowboys. They're sheriffs cleaning up the town.
Let's take Superman. Superman emerges in Action Comics number one in... it's actually in the spring.
Throwing a car, isn't he? He's
38.
Throwing a car at someone.
The issue's dated June, but he appears in the spring. He's the product of two guys. They're very young, and they're Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster. They have met at high school, Jewish background. Actually, sort of. So many of these people have got Ashkenazi, Eastern European, Jewish roots. They've changed their names.
And they're frozen out of kind of New York publishing, aren't they? Is that right?
Yes. So that's actually the case of almost all these people, that they have struggled in some way. Their comic books are seen as déclassé.
They go into writing comic books because that's essentially the only way that they can get paid for writing.
Exactly. So they create Superman. And Superman, it's 1938, so America is still actually really in the grip of the Great Depression, later than Britain is. So it's politically very febrile. The Superman character, the costume... it hadn't occurred to me until I sort of read up on this that he's based on circus strongmen.
Yes, that's why he wears his pants outside.
The pants and the tights, yeah. I mean, which seems so laughable to us today, at the time were seen as emblematic of great
of strength,
masculinity. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Not at all ridiculous. Because Shuster is a big fan of strongmen and fitness culture.
I mean, it is a bit ridiculous. I mean, it is a kind of showmanship. I mean, you go to a circus knowing that you're seeing something that's not real.
But do they see that? Do they see that in the 30s? So. Do they see that same eyes? I don't think they see it quite the same eyes as we.
Well, maybe, but to a degree, I think.
But at the beginning, Superman has this sort of social activist side. So he's taking on crooked businessmen, crooked financiers, people who are exploiting the poor. There's a definite kind of liberal New Deal politics.
Yeah, but it's also, I mean, why do you have to rely on a Superman to do that for you? Why can't you rely on the police? Why can't you rely on
strong trade unions? Is that what you're
on strong trade unions? Exactly. You have to, you know, you have to turn to this kind of big guy with his pants on.
But there are two other political elements. One is that the Clark Kent character, the character of the sort of downtrodden, nerdy guy who comes good. That's quite a theme in kind of interwar culture, the little man, people would call it in Britain, the sort of the underrated, underestimated chap who actually triumphs over all those who've... I mean, that's also, you know, slightly Horatio Alger in America, the kind of the poor boy made good kind of thing. I mean, that's absolutely rooted in the culture of the time. And the other thing is that a lot of people who've written about comic books point out that Superman is, of course, an immigrant. Yeah, he's a newcomer. And these books...
Because he's come from Krypton.
And these... Well, I mean, okay, he's got to come from somewhere. But these stories are written by people who are often, you know, second-generation immigrants themselves. So it's the sort of assimilation into the American way of outsiders. Yeah. And that's there in the Superman story.
Although, in a way, Superman isn't assimilated, is he? I mean, that's the point. I mean, all these superheroes are not, in the long run, assimilated. And that becomes a theme.
Yeah,
right the way
of
up
course.
To the present day, you know, because X-Men are mutants, Batman's basically a kind of psychopath. I mean, all these people, and the more kind of sophisticated reworkings of these stories make play with the fact that actually there's something slightly difficult about these
people
in capes and cloaks kind of beating people up.
Well, I think...
So Clark Kent and Superman is presumably a kind of embodiment of the schizophrenic quality...
I suppose so.
Of an immigrant.
Yeah, both belonging and not belonging, I suppose. And that's also true. It's almost schizophrenic. I mean, Batman is created, a year later? Bob Kane, who's actually, you know, Robert Kahn, another Ashkenazi Jewish writer, Bob Kane and Bill Finger. So that's Detective Comics in March 1939. Now, Batman is slightly different because he's
he doesn't have a superpower, does he?
No. So he really is the Scarlet Pimpernel in Gotham City. He is a rich, feckless aristocrat, or somebody who appears to be that, i.e. Bruce Wayne. And the even the Christopher Nolan films have that element to them.
His parents have been killed by muggers.
Right, and becomes a vigilante. So obviously that's kind of, you can see that as reflecting anxieties about crime and all that sort of stuff.
And a huge question.
Yeah.
Why does he dress up as a bat?
Well, there's been lots of arguments about this. Because what's interesting with all these characters is there's always subsequent rows between the writer and the illustrator about who the real inventor is.
Yes.
There's a claim, isn't there, that they got the inspiration for the bat wings from Leonardo da Vinci.
Yes, see that? Ornithopter.
Yes.
His flying machine.
But you know why he's called Bruce Wayne?
No.
So his name, says Bill Finger, the writer. Bruce Wayne's first name came from Robert the Bruce.
Oh, he's Scottish.
And he then thought he wanted a name that reminded Americans of colonialism. He tried Adams, Hancock, sort of founding fathers, U.S. War of Independence figures. And then I thought of Mad Anthony Wayne, who apparently I'd never heard of him, actually. He's a general in the American U.S. War of Independence. And he gives him that name. So hence,
oh, there you go. I had no
Bruce
idea.
Wayne.
Now, Batman is a great podcast this is. I'm learning
Batman,
stuff every day.
Batman is, well, we're both learning. We're learning all the time, Tom.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what I learned, and this I did think this was amazing, and it's a slight problem because this is a podcast, but the Joker,
yeah,
Batman's long-running adversary, the look of him apparently came from this 1928 silent film, The Man Who Laughs, Conrad Veidt. Had you seen that before? So I looked it up, and I don't know how they got away with it. It's exactly the same.
It is exactly, but that's how all of these comic books work then these days. Yeah. I mean, they're seen as very kind of lowbrow kids' entertainment. So obviously they're ripping off things left, right, and center. And of course they get away with it because no one thinks at the time they're creating franchises that will last the 21st century. They just think this is disposable pulp fiction that will be, you know, almost instantly forgotten. So you have all these, I believe you have do you not have some sort of list of amusing characters who didn't?
I do. Because, of course, Superman and Batman, very successful and presumably turbocharged by the war, right?
Yeah, I think so.
So
they're fighting
Captain
Hitler,
America.
Captain America, of course.
Fighting
ultra-patriotic
and everything.
Figure.
And so through the war, the war years, you have this vast explosion of superheroes. And so there were some that didn't make it. So this kind of Darwinian struggle for superheroes to make it through. So there was Madame Fatal.
That's a good
name. Who was actually Richard Stanton, a retired actor who fought crime disguised as an old lady.
Okay, that wasn't... I can see why that didn't work out.
This is one mentioned by Capel Loft, who is obviously trying to suck up to us after
this. So formerly a friend of the show, then kind of a...
He set up a rival World Cup of Kings
and
Queens.
He did set up. But now he's really... He's changed his ways.
He has. He's reformed. And he nominated the Deacon, who is a reformed burglar who fights crime disguised as a Church of England clergyman. I can't understand why that hasn't caught on.
Why don't they make films about him?
No, Marvel all over
why
that.
Why isn't Tom Holland playing the Deacon? That's my question.
There's the gay ghost.
What's the gay ghost do?
The gay ghost is an 18th century nobleman in Ireland who's a ghost.
Right. Okay.
And that's his superpower. He's a
okay.
Ghost.
I can kind of see.
But also, there's a supervillain called the Sportsmaster, whose villainy consists of throwing sports kit at people.
Well, like kind of a cricket box or like
cricket,
kind of
exactly
some cones.
Exactly. Or I was kind of thinking, you know, those things that you jump over in
right.
kind of 1950s gyms,
sort of hurdles.
Yeah, and balls and things like that. Right. But I mean, quite
I would find that terrifying, quite, actually.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, how do you go around being, you know, robbing banks or whatever, lugging a great bag full of sports kit just in case you're attacked? So you can kind of see why that one didn't work out.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's terrible. There's a fellow who's got a lot of bees. No, isn't there? A man who's got lots of bees hidden in his belt. And he releases them. I can't remember what he's called, the Red Bee or something like that.
Yeah, anyway, it's all very...
But somebody who could
have
been...
Nothing, you know, this has nothing to do with ancient antecedents or...
Well, no, but it's history, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's the culture of the 1930s and 40s. And actually...
It is, but what I'm saying is that this is not drawing on deep-rooted memories
but,
of...
Okay, here's a character for you, Tom, that does drawn deep-rooted memories, i.e. the myth of the Amazons. So all the characters we talked about have been
Wonder Woman.
So Wonder Woman is, she arrives, so we've had Superman 38, Batman 39, Wonder Woman comes along in 1941, and she is Princess Diana.
Of the Amazons.
Of Themyscira, which is an island inhabited by Amazons. She's the daughter of Queen Hippolyta. Yeah.
Yes.
So she has a very impressive kind of ancient world pedigree, doesn't she?
She does, but she is, you know, this is still Mr. Ben.
Right.
Because actually what Wonder Woman is drawing on is not deep-rooted memories of ancient Greece, but the fantasies of a guy called William Moulton Marston, who was a professor of psychology. He's said to be the inventor of the lie detector, isn't he? But apparently he ripped it off from his wife. His wife invented it, and he then kind of passed it off.
Well, this is an extraordinary story. So he's like a Harvard-educated psychologist who's credited, not least by himself, with having invented the polygraph and doing all this.
But he lied.
His personality test, well, ironically.
Hilarious.
All these personality tests. So he is married to another psychologist called Elizabeth, but they live with, they have a kind of, there are three of them in this marriage. Yeah.
And they're always tying each other up.
Olive Byrne. And they're always doing bondage with each other and stuff.
And so a Wonder Woman, of course, has her magic lasso.
Yeah.
Which, and she's always tying people up. But more germanely, Wonder Woman herself is always being chained, bound, gagged.
And he's completely upfront about this, isn't he?
Well, no, but the more he writes them, the more... the more the bondage comes in.
Exactly.
So there's this great line. At one point, Wonder Woman actually cries out, "Great girdle of Aphrodite, I'm so tired of being tied up." But you know she isn't really. You know she loves it.
He's utterly upfront about it. So he's fascinated by comic books. He thinks they're the way to... They're very kind of idealistic, kind of highbrow people, Marston and Byrne, or whatever they're called. And he says himself, Wonder Woman is psychological propaganda for the new type of woman who I believe should rule the world.
Mm.
He says too many girls lack force, strength, and power. He wants to, the obvious remedy is to create a feminine character with all the strength of Superman, plus all the allure of a good and beautiful woman.
Well, he thinks that there is strength in submission. So there's an amazing plot where Wonder Woman rescues a group of women who've been enslaved by an evil Nazi, and the Nazi gets defeated. But the twist is that the girls who've been rescued then miss being slaves. So Wonder Woman sends them off to the Amazons, where they can all live happily as slaves.
It's very strange. There's another quote from him here. "The only hope for peace is to teach people who are full of pep and unbound force to enjoy being bound. Only when the control of self by others is more pleasant than the unbound assertion of self can we hope for a stable, peaceful human society."
And the risk of women not being allowed to express this is conveyed through the character of Dr. Poison. Have you
tell me about Dr.
Her?
Poison? No,
so Dr. Poison is an evil supervillain who loves humiliating women, confronts Wonder Woman, and amazingly is revealed to be a woman.
Golly, that's
whose
a
love
twist.
Of submission has been frustrated and therefore has corrupted her into becoming this evil figure.
Yeah. So you can see why there are deep waters. And obviously in the 1950s, there was this tremendous backlash, wasn't there?
Yes, you can see why.
And there's this guy who's himself a kind of a psychiatrist, I think, called Frederick Wortham, who writes a book called The Seduction of the Innocent, published in 1954, which causes this tremendous stir. It's taken up by congressional hearings and stuff, where he basically says comic books and superhero stories are corrupting youth. And he says at one point, kids who read Superman won't listen to their parents or teachers because their parents and teachers will seem so weak and bland by comparison. Ergo, we should stamp out Superman.
But, I mean, that's the kind of the equivalent of saying that we can't allow vigilantes and sheriffs to kind of shoot people in the Wild West. I mean, that exactly proves my point.
Well, I mean, he the interesting thing is he's loathed and hated by comic book enthusiasts because they see him as having.
But
obviously, some of the things that he identifies, so he identifies the bondage, and he does identify what some people might see as a slightly fascistic, or what you clearly see as a slightly fascistic element to superhero stories. So the idea of a Superman, somebody with powers who takes the law into their own hands. Wortham says in 1954, all this stuff is terrible. And I guess some people today would probably agree with him.
I think that that's what's interesting about the turn that public morality has taken, which is that actually it's a reprise of quite a lot of perspectives in the 50s. So now, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, you know, brilliant, bondage, woohoo. Yeah. Now it's seen as more problematic again. Or is it? I guess that that's why superheroes are interesting, is that they do hold a mirror up to, because they're an incredibly democratic, incredibly popular form, they do hold up a really, really fascinating mirror to the way that neuroses and cultural anxieties and morality panics and virtue spirals operate in the United States over the past century, basically.
And you say the United States because they are, it's interesting, they are, really there have arrogant. Of course been attempts to have, there's Captain Britain and so on, but they are really specifically American, aren't they?
And I think that's why I was never interested in them particularly.
Because you're Americanophobic.
No, they just seem very, very foreign to me. So I guess I had no problem reading Asterix. I loved Asterix and Tintin. They seem kind of part of the world that I inhabited. But these, you know, square-jawed men with trilbies in mean streets. I mean, it was a long way from Wiltshire.
Well, this is your Ted Heathism, isn't it? Ted Heath would agree with you.
Yeah,
he would see you as a great, you know, when he was taking Britain into Europe, you as a fellow Wiltshire enthusiast.
But I think the other reason why, and this kind of opens up maybe the next stage, but I'll just say this before we go to the break, is that rather like I never took James Bond seriously because I grew up with Roger Moore as James Bond. So also, basically, my introduction to superheroes was Adam West and Burt Ward as Batman and Robin, which was played almost entirely for laughs. Well,
completely for laughs.
You know, the bat shark repellent gas.
The pow wham kind of stuff that appears on screen.
Exactly. And the villains. So Vincent Price's Egghead. There was the professor who kept turning into Tutankhamun. I love that.
Yeah.
There was Cesar Romero as the Joker who refused to shave his moustache.
So they
painted over it. And I was watching some of the footage. I hadn't thought about it for years and years, but it was still held up. A routine question. Have you recently sold any war surplus submarines? And if so, to whom? And it's Leslie Nielsen. It's the Naked Gun.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I think, you know, that's basically why I've never been able to take it seriously.
Well, let's hope you take it seriously in the second half, because we will, of course, be coming to your own favourite superhero.
Ah, yes, Spider-Man.
Spidey. We'll see you after the break. The most popular Marvel hero is much lower on the social scale. He is the maladjusted adolescent Spider-Man, the only overtly neurotic superhero I've ever come across. Spider-Man has a terrible identity problem, a marked inferiority complex, and a fear of women. He is antisocial, castration-ridden, racked with Oedipal guilt, and accident-prone. How can a character as healthy as Superman compete with this living symbol of the modern dilemma, this neurotic Spider-Man, the super anti-hero of our time? Now, Tom, that was the Village Voice in 1965. Do you want to stand up for your alter ego?
I hadn't realised it. I hadn't realised that that's who I was.
It's just uncanny, isn't it?
It's
uncanny.
It's eerie.
The stuff about castration, for example. I mean, the number of times you brought that up on the podcast and the Village Voice are on your case.
Yeah, that's amazing.
So,
although as someone said, I mean, Peter Parker was also, he was chairman of British Rail, wasn't he, in the 70s?
So he went out with Shirley Williams. Shirley Williams had a crush on Peter Parker when they were at Oxford. So, yes, we're now coming. So the stuff that we're talking about in the first half is known by comic book enthusiasts as the Golden Age of comics and of superheroes.
I thought it was also the Silver Age.
I think this is the...
According to Grant Morrison, the Golden Age is the Second World War.
Yeah. We're about to talk about the Silver Age.
And then the Silver Age is the 1950s.
So what's the Spider-Man?
When Superman was drawn by an artist called Wayne Boring.
I knew you wanted to mention Wayne Boring.
Yeah, I did. That's funny.
I think the Silver Age goes into the 60s.
Does it?
And that's where you get the
It's
second...
like debates over the Renaissance, isn't it?
It is.
When does it begin? When does it end?
I mean, these crazy rabbit holes.
Yeah, the long 19th century.
I've spent hours on the internet just getting deeper and deeper, totally out of my depth. On the difference, you know, so there's two different Captain Marvels, one belonging to DC and one to Marvel. Very
really?
Confusingly.
So anyway. Tell me about DC and Marvel. I don't understand this.
So they're just rival companies. It's very simple. And they're rival companies and they're both associated with slightly different eras. So they've always been, they've had different names.
So DC is the classic ones.
So Batman DC is Superman. Batman, Superman, and so on. Marvel's heyday comes in the so-called Silver Age, and what they have Stan Lee and a guy called Jack Kirby and a guy called Steve Ditko. Again, of all of them, you know, we've got Jewish backgrounds, so dual identities, New York, based in New York.
And this is the one that's a coherent world.
Yes. And what they do, which is brilliant, is that they, unlike DC, realize that they have to adjust to a completely new kind of generational tone. In the early 1960s, they do it first with a team called the Fantastic Four. My son absolutely adores the Fantastic Four. The Fantastic Four start in 1961. Mr. Fantastic, the Invisible Woman, the Human Torch, and the Thing, and they're a kind of family group. It's very space age, unlike so the earlier ones, Batman and so on, feel very 1930s. These guys are astronauts. They are fighting the communists. They want to get into space.
This is against the backdrop of. Kennedy, space race,
exactly. All that
so scientists,
stuff.
Because in the early ones, scientists are kind of villains.
Yeah,
and they're always.
Whereas now, almost all the Marvel heroes of the '60s, science has gone wrong in some way, but science is also their friend and their weapon. And actually, mm-hmm. there's the U.S. State Department supposedly had said to publishers, "We want you to push science. We want you to embrace science because they were, you know, they." That obviously mattered in the context of the technological competition with the Soviet Union.
And so, Spider-Man gets bitten by a radioactive spider, right?
Exactly.
I know this from
so the Fantastic Four are terribly successful, and they're scientific, and they also bicker among themselves. They're a sort of realist, not realistic, but you know what I mean. They're slightly more naturalistic,
the thing.
Kind of family group. Now, Spider-Man takes Peter Parker, who would normally have been a sidekick, i.e., Robin. And it places him center stage with no mentor. So he's a teenager. It's the first one where the teenager...
But isn't his mentor... what's his name?
Uncle Ben.
No. The guy who dresses up in metal.
Iron Man. Dresses up in metal. It's like listening to my dad describing Star Wars.
I know. Implausible.
There are two metal men. I think
Robert Downey Jr.
He is in the films, but I don't think he is in the comic books.
Is he not?
Or at least not early on in the first.
Okay. But one of the interesting details I enjoyed reading in Grant Morrison's book was that Peter Parker apparently designed his Spider-Man outfit to look good on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah. So
which is what the Beatles then appeared on.
Of course. Yeah.
So spiders, Beatles.
So Peter Parker is very much rooted in the world of the 1960s. He's at high school. Later on, when he goes to university, some of his classmates are involved in demos and student protests and things.
And so that's why it matters that the other Tom Holland looks young.
It has to look young. You can't have an old.
But the other ones didn't, did they?
They did. Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield. They were a tiny bit older. Tom Holland's probably the youngest. Tom Holland, I mean, you are Tom Holland. he's probably the youngest. And the most firmly rooted in the kind of high school, high school stuff. And of course, you know who says, with great power comes with great responsibility, Tom?
Spider-Man.
No.
Don't know.
Nobody says it.
Don't they?
The line is actually, with great power, there must also come great responsibility. My son was very keen that I point this out on the podcast.
Okay, and that's Stan Lee
who says it. It's the narrator.
The head of Marvel Comics, Stan Lee, just give them a lot of action and don't use too many words.
Yeah, so they're quite kinetic. They're sort of updated for the 60s.
Okay, but Dominic, and then, convince me that this is of any interest at all from a historical point of view. I mean, it's all very interesting, yes, whatever, but... So what?
I think it's a huge part of American popular culture in the 1960s. It obviously.
But what's it telling us about America? What's it revealing? What mirror is it showing up to the? cultural neuroses of the age.
I think what it is that, I mean, Spider-Man and similar comics, they wrestle with kind of social issues of the 60s and later in the 70s. So, for example, there's a character called Green Lantern. In 1970, they have issues all about drugs, all about the war on drugs and so on, and drug addiction and things. And you get Black Panther. Now, with your sort of
Wakanda, or is that right?
Yeah, Wakanda. I think Wakanda. I don't think it's called Wakanda. No,
it can't be called Wakanda.
Even you, with your imperviousness to the fear of cancellation, you're not going to slag off Black Panther because Black Panther.
I don't know anything about it. I don't know anything about it.
A sort of touchstone for diversity in Hollywood. People are very excited about Black Panther, but Black Panther was started in 1966, and he's the first kind of really successful black superhero.
And which came first, the Black Panthers or Black Panther?
That's a really good question.
So were the Black Panthers naming themselves after a superhero?
I don't know. Maybe listeners, people should go onto the Discord chat and
No, I think you should look it up on Wikipedia right now.
Right. Live research. Live research. Okay, fine.
Because I'll be honest, if the Black Panthers named themselves after comic book,
then it will matter.
I'm going to think less of them.
God, there's so much tension riding on this. Origins.
But then if Black Panther is named after the Black Panthers, then that's kind of quite edgy.
So they name themselves in October 1966. They adopt the Black Panther logo in their own organization, black uniforms and all that stuff. And when does the comic start? The tension, Tom.
It's massive. This is so exciting. Have we ever done research live?
Live research. July 1966. Black Panther comes first. The character.
There you go. Then I think... Well,
so I've been utterly vindicated. Tom now recognises that comic books do matter enormously.
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I don't know whether they knew of the comic, though. Were they reading the comics?
It seems a bit of a coincidence.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Black Panther now really matters. I mean, Black Panther is seen as probably more than anything that Hollywood has done in the last 10 or 20 years. And, you know, as an embodiment of its newfound kind of progressiveness. So when the Black Panther film came out, it was nominated for Oscars and stuff, and it's absolutely seen as emblematic of a kind of new multiracial kind of popular culture. So there you go. And also, Tom, actually, talking about comic books and superheroes as a mirror, they absolutely are a mirror, because in the 30s and 40s, you have...
I know they are. That's what I was saying. I was trying to get you back on track.
You have Superman type heroes.
Yeah,
in the 60s, you have teenagers. Then in the 70s, they turn inwards and a lot of characters start getting killed off. And then in the 80s, you have this whole new kind of wave.
So
go on.
Tim Burton. The Tim Burton film.
No, before that.
So what's happening in the 80s?
So there's a guy called Frank Miller, who you will know because of 300.
Oh, I do know Frank Miller. Yeah, so The Dark Knight Returns.
The Dark Knight Returns, and now you have an older Batman. It's much more aggressive. It is much more... I mean, Frank Miller is kind of a libertarian, isn't he? Very conservative. It's much more incredibly violent.
And The Dark Knight Returns, and you must like this, is it's an America where Reagan
is permanent,
is about
president.
Kind of 120.
Yes, exactly, where Reagan is president.
And the
life,
same thing in Watchmen, which I'm sure we'll come to in a minute, where Nixon is still in power.
Yes.
So there's a kind of weird thing going on where Republican presidents never retire. So what's
going on there? Sort of paranoid imagination of comic book writers. Comic book writers tend not to be... you know, sort of centrists, steady as she goes, establishment centrists. They tend to be on the kind of, you would say, the ideological fringes of the left or right. Frank Miller on one side, Alan Moore, the great British comic book writer.
He's British, because quite a lot of these kind of edgy reworkings of American standards have kind of, they're coming from British art schools, right?
Absolutely. So Alan Moore, who's from Northampton, he writes this absolutely classic comic book called Watchmen, listed by Time magazine as one of the 100 best books of the 20th
century. I've
seen
the film. The
comic book is absolutely fantastic if you like comic books. And actually, there's a TV series that came out 2 years ago that won tons and tons of Emmys and was absolutely brilliant, because what the TV... So the comic book is basically saying slightly, what if superheroes were real and what if they had carried on living? What would
and they helped
like?
America to win the Vietnam War, didn't they?
Yeah. What would it be like to be a costumed vigilante, with or without powers? And actually, it also picks up, because it has a superhero who basically becomes God. called Dr. Manhattan. He goes and lives on Mars. He has the power of life and death. He can kind of remake reality as he sees fit.
But it's not as good as Kick-Ass.
I haven't seen Kick-Ass.
Oh, Kick-Ass is great. Kick-Ass is about a comic book fan who dresses up as a superhero.
But then what the TV series of Watchmen does, which I think is really interesting and, again, a very good mirror. So that came out about 2 years ago. And that took the Watchmen story a level further because it set it against the backdrop partly of the Tulsa race massacre in 1921. This great sort of terrible moment in American history.
Aerial attack, isn't it?
Supposedly aerial attacks on a black quarter of Tulsa, then the most thriving black city in America. And what the Watchmen TV series does is it points out the sort of similarity. I mean, masked vigilantes, that's what the Ku Klux Klan are. They're masked vigilantes.
Right. So I'm right. So it is a right-wing fantasy.
Well, I mean, this is what that series kind of plays with. Are they on the side of the poor and of justice and all that sort of stuff? Or are they kind of fascistic? Which is also what you see in the Christopher Nolan Batman films.
Yeah.
The Batman figure. So in the final film of the Christopher Nolan Batman films, The Dark Knight Rises, I think.
That's the one with Heath Ledger.
No, that's the middle one. So it's the one with Tom Hardy.
Hear a word he says.
Got his mask.
Yes.
I am Gotham's reckoning. All that kind of stuff. So in that film, there are sort of Tale of Two Cities quotations and stuff like that. There's a revolution in Gotham that Bane causes. And Batman is basically fighting on behalf of the forces of order, the establishment, the rich, because he's rich, of course, himself. That's Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
So that's sort of having some fun, I think, with the politics of it. But actually, what's really interesting is that I think we talked about this before with Bond, how in the 21st century, you just can't do unironic, unselfconscious, heroic superheroes anymore. They have to be conflicted. There has to be a traumatic backstory.
Okay, so why is that, do we think?
Because
obviously one of the things that intervened, so we've got a question here from Sam Burrows. In the wake of 9/11, recessions and pandemics, do you think the current obsession with superheroes is actually a product of nostalgia, a longing for a time in which things felt good? Presumably, if you're saying it's impossible to have unironic superheroes anymore, that's not the case.
I don't know. Are the Marvel films nostalgia? I don't know, because they're appealing to people who are younger than us. So what are they being what are they nostalgic for? You know, my son, who is 10 in a few days, he and his friends all love the Marvel films, but that they don't like them out of nostalgia. I mean, they have no interest in being nostalgic.
The X-Men films that I saw, because my daughter got very into them briefly, were based around there was the Bay of Pigs episode. The Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
And then there was one about an attempt to stop the Vietnam War.
So that kind of was nostalgic.
Very rooted in, and it's involved Wolverine going back in time.
See, I think there's a general retreat from heroism, isn't there? If I was writing an essay about it for Unheard, I would
going against the herd mentality.
Exactly. I might well say that it was a sort of loss of faith in the West. I mean, is that too?
Well, I agree, because you see the same thing with Westerns, which seem to me very analogous.
Yeah.
That it's about good guys cleaning up. Sorting out the baddies.
But you're not. You can't
have an unironic Western now.
No, I mean in all these.
And is
films,
it not? And you talked about Black Panther. I mean, is it not also tied up with anxieties about white privilege?
Bruce Wayne would be the absolute
embodiment.
So I'm really interesting, because there's a Robert Pattinson version of Batman that's coming out that looks very, from the trailer, look incredibly dark. And actually, that's been the trend since the Dark Knight Returns, Frank Miller stuff, so that Batman becomes more and more of a villain. I mean, there's that scene that you almost always get. You got it in the last Bond film. You get it in everything now. We're not so different, you and I. You know, the villain talking to the hero. And you're like, oh, that's very profound. They're two sides of the same coin. But you see that.
Wouldn't it be great to see, you know, the Adam West style? Pow,
yeah,
zam.
We're actually, yeah, and the hero saying, actually, we're very different.
You're a villain. I'm taking you in.
Exactly,
Commissioner Gordon. Yeah, cuff him.
Yeah,
yeah. I think there'd be a market for that.
I think that's probably the way to go, isn't it?
when I set up my studio,
there'll be some sort of generational backlash, and there'll be as there was in the 70s with the creation of Star Wars and the demand for kind of a clearer line between good and evil. Don't you think that'll come eventually? We'd have to say stay immersed in kind of cynicism forever, or do
we?
I don't know.
Well, cynicism man.
Yeah, that's your power.
Pessimism man.
Multiple people actually have asked us this question. Which superhero do we suit best? Stephen Clark, for example. So, Tom, if you were a superhero, who would you be? Or what would your...
I'd probably be the Deacon.
You'd be the Deacon?
Or maybe the Sportsmaster.
Yeah, because you're cricketing.
My cricket bat, I just hurl. Yeah.
Who do you think I would be?
I think you'd be... would you be the Incredible Hulk?
Yeah, I do spend a lot of time getting angry. So... And I do go green when roused. So yeah, maybe I'll take it.
Yeah. Obviously I'd be Thor.
Would you? Why? Yeah.
Brawny, good looking. Great with a hammer.
I'm tempted to do my impersonation of Anthony Hopkins throwing you out of Asgard, but I won't.
I've no idea what you're talking about.
No, you don't. Right. Have I convinced you that superheroes matter, that they're historically interesting?
I think so, until you slightly went off-piste in the 60s. And I don't think they really matter now.
Well, that wasn't off-piste.
I think their emergence, the early stuff, I think that's interesting.
Yeah, you don't think the 60s stuff is interesting?
Not particularly, no.
Shocking. I think when people... We did a whole episode about teenagers, and Peter Parker is nothing if not a teenager. He's a teenager from...
Yeah, but say what? I mean, it's like the monkeys. Would we do an episode on the monkeys? I mean, it's basically the monkeys, isn't it?
I suppose it is a bit, but yeah, I mean,
it's the monkeys in a kind of weird suit.
Yeah. All right. Well.
But one final question, which is, I think another reason why I'm quite actively hostile to the whole thing, is that I feel bullied by
people wishing you happy birthday on Twitter under the impression that you're 17.
I feel bullied by the kind of juggernaut quality of this essentially special effects driven. I mean, I the ones that I've seen, I'm with Ridley Scott and Martin Scorsese. I think they're stupid and dumb and
I think that's too harsh. I think they are.
I'm aware, but I'm 53. I was never interested in the first place. So I'd be interested in your view on, I mean, they do seem to me expressive of a kind of new era of American cultural supremacy. So they seem to me the cinematic equivalent of the dominance of Google and Apple and Amazon, these vast, colossal edifices before which everyone else are just kind of tiny little
I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think they have sucked... I think they're extremely well made and they're very effective. I've actually never seen one without falling asleep because I find the narrative so formulaic that I actually find them quite boring. But I can't help noticing that all the 9 and 10 year olds, boys, are my acquaintance, I'd love them. The one thing I will say is I think the air is seeping out of that balloon because I think their box office returns have been dwindling a little bit in the last couple of years.
Trounced by James Bond, I gather.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah.
Although it'd be interesting to see how Spider-Man does. My name.
Are you going to go and see it?
I'm not, no.
So Tom Holland is doing something else now, which is gutting for you, isn't he? What's he doing?
Yeah, he's doing Fred Astaire.
Fred Astaire.
He's a great dancer. I mean, you must have seen him. Have you
Tom
seen
Holland? When?
Famous thing where he is Fred Astaire and then he turns into Rihanna. You must have seen that.
No, what is that?
Oh, it's brilliant. It's how he announced himself when he got named as Spider-Man before the first Spider-Man film came out. Yeah. He went on this kind of dance-a-thon. Where you have to, dance to well-known music. Yeah. And he comes on and he's Fred Astaire and he's got the umbrella and it's raining. And then he goes off and he comes back on. He's dressed as Rihanna and he does Umbrella. It's absolutely brilliant if you haven't seen it.
Okay. He's dressed as Rihanna.
Yeah.
Isn't that quite risky now? I mean, cultural appropriation and all that kind of stuff.
No, he's non-binary.
Is he? He's not. You've made that
two,
up.
Two spirits. Spirits. He's making play with gender stereotypes and
is he?
And
right.
Yes. It's.
You heard it here first from Tom Holland himself.
That's right. What it's all about.
And on that bombshell, I think
he was. He's obviously paying homage to Madame Fatale.
Of course he was.
Retired actor who fights crime disguised as an old lady.
It's goodbye from me, the Incredible Hulk, and it's goodbye from him, the sportsman, and we will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.